You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and you are listening to a long-running lecture series of broadcasts called The Russian Orthodox Nationalist. Today's date is the 16th of November, 2024, and we're going to go back in this program to the very early 1990s in the Soviet Union. There is an article which I'm going to deal with exclusively this evening by Igor Shafarovich. He's a Russo-Ukrainian mathematician who died in 2017. And he became well known for his 1990 essay called Russophobia. Initially published in Russian in 1989, the English version was published in March of 1990. By the U.S. Commerce Department in a journal called the JPRS Report. In this case, the volume is titled Soviet Union Political Affairs. And in fact, my copy contains a stamp of Commerce directly on the cover. Of course, the point of it is to have good translations of local journalism by more or less recognized writers for Western consumption, but even more importantly, it's about a country's investment climate and its public opinion. One of the key elements in Russophobia as an essay, and Shafarovich has actually coined the term, one which I only very rarely use, he developed the concept of a lesser people. It's an elite subculture, a tiny minority within a country, within a nation. Now, lesser people is an odd phrase. Russian is maloga. In this case, it refers to the few, the elite, not lesser or little in the sense of being minor or insignificant. It is rather the chosen few that seek nothing less than taking complete power over the society. And they are completely alienated from the larger nation that surrounds them and are constantly at war with it. Now, Russophobia, the essay was written in the waning days of the Soviet Union. It had about a year left. And it's a review of the ideas of certain Russian and Jewish liberals at the time, specifically Boris Shragin, who wrote The Challenge of the Spirit, and Alexander Yanov, who wrote Détente after Brezhnev and The New Russian Right, among many other things. Now, the context is very important. This is a seminal essay that was the opening shot, at least as far as mainstream society goes, of the Eurasianist and nationalist idea. It was written in the twilight of the Soviet Union. Because Leninism was completely refuted and Russian society was very deeply divided because there was no ideology to unify anybody, the division really was between liberals and Eurasianists, to use these terms very broadly. I was in college when this was going on, and I remember reading at the time the mainstream newspapers, especially the New York Times, every single day concerning these developments. So what everyone was saying was that since the West is victorious, therefore it became the choice of the intellectuals, at least for a short time. Most of the time, then and now, liberal just meant heavily Jewish and receiving support from the West, especially in its universities, especially the Ivy League. In the 1970s, the Soviet Union ceased being profitable for its elite. The construction boom after World War II was getting old. At the same time, Western technology had shot ahead of the Soviets. After the creation of Israel, of course, Soviet Jews began looking outside the USSR. So very suddenly, Jews turned on the Soviet experiment. I still remember talk about the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. It came up quite a bit in the early 90s. It was passed in 1974, and it places sanctions on any government, and it was aimed at the USSR, that refused to grant exit visas to Jews upon demand. All of a sudden, the USSR was no longer the wave of the future. Of course, the gulags were ignored for decades, but it was only when the Jews wanted to emigrate to buttress Israel was any kind of action taken against the Kremlin. Otherwise, trade with the USSR was constant and continuous. 1 year later, Anatoly Chubais and Yuri Gaidar, 1991, the two leading Jews, among many others, who implemented the austerity policies, the liberal policies, which eventually gave rise to the equally Jewish oligarchs backed by the USA. Their policies under President Boris Yeltsin led to total economic collapse, such that it threatened Russia itself. Of course, it made Yeltsin immensely unpopular. So in a rigged election of 1996, with the full stamp of approval from the West, a very unpopular Yeltsin was re-elected, so the open society experiment can continue. Just 1 year before that, Russophobia was written, although the outlines of the coming disaster were visible as a matter of logic if the liberal choice were to be accepted. The collapse was right around the corner, and liberals are to blame, both in Russia and in the United States. But before I go any further, it's important to note that in order to refute something, to argue against something, whoever's doing the arguing has to know the nature of the argument he's refuting, and to be able to state it as charitably as possible, something our enemies refuse to do. So and he actually laid out the groundwork for this, and I just expanded on it, 8 points of the basic fundamental general argument. It's more like a schema. Jews and liberals in Russia roughly 1990 were saying, the so-called lesser people. And so this is what liberals were saying at the time and continue to say today. This is their foundation. Number one, Russian history, starting with its own Middle Ages, has been defined by certain inbred Russian traits. These are a servile mentality, a lack of self-worth, intolerance toward foreign views, and a mixture of feelings of malice, envy, and admiration towards foreign powers. Number two, running parallel to Russian history, ever since roughly the 15th century, there have been dreams of some sort in Russia, some role or mission in the world, the desire to teach something to other nations, to point out something new, even to save the world. This is Russian messianism, I should say, called, of course, universal Russian arrogance, the origin of which our authors see in the concept of Moscow, the Third Rome, expressed in the 16th century, whose present-day stage they see the idea of the World Socialist Revolution and why it began, or was first established on Russian soil. Number three, as a result of all this, Russia has continually found itself in the power of despotic regimes and bloody revolution, cataclysms. The proof lies in the ages of Ivan the Terrible, Peter I, and Stalin. Number four, Russians are unable to understand the reasons for their misfortunes. Looking with suspicion and hostility on everything foreign, they are inclined to blame everyone conceivable for their woes, Tartars, Greeks, Germans, Jews, so long as it's not themselves. Number five, in essence, 1917 was not a Marxist revolution. Marxism was distorted by the Russians, altered and used to restore old Russian traditions of a strong state. The cruelties of the revolutionary era and the Stalinist period are attributed to the distinctive features of the Russian national character. Stalin is seen as very national, very Russian phenomenon. His policies were a direct continuation of Russia's barbarous history. Stalinism is traced at least 4 centuries back. Number six, as of this writing, 1990, The same tendency continues to manifest itself even now, freeing itself from the alien European culture it never quite understood. The country is now coming to increasingly resemble the old Muscovite kingdom. Number 7, the chief danger looming over Russia at present lay in the attempts that are being revived to find some sort of unique path to development. And this is a manifestation of old Russian nationalism. And such an attempt will inevitably result in an upsurge of Russian ethno-nationalism, the revival of Stalinism, and a wave, of course, of anti-Semitism. And finally, number 8, all of this is mortally dangerous, not just for the peoples of the Soviet Union, but for all humanity, especially the Jews. The only salvation lay in recognizing this pernicious tendency, or these tendencies, eradicating them and building a society according to the model of Western democracies, that is to say, liberal capitalism. So from a historical point of view, this is their foundational argument. And a few things, you know, when I read these people, he's right. This is basically it. But it's funny how race makes an appearance, but only where their enemies are concerned. These are genetically inbred traits. In other words, they have no choice in the matter. They also have no intellect and no free will. That's for others. So really, this school doesn't have much hope for Russians as a nation. In fact, they go so far as to say that Russia's never had a history. Russians have only demonstrated their historical impotence, and Russia is doomed to imminent collapse and destruction, which, according to these people, is a good thing. Since men create history, and Russia has no history, according to them, Russians are not human. While not logically perfect, it certainly does represent their point of view pretty accurately. Now, what I read out is very simplistic. But it is accurate in the sense that it is the liberal and Jewish position then and now. But its falsity is blatantly manifest. You notice all of these claims are unprovable. They're all tendencies. They all rest on a tremendous ignorance of Russian history. And clearly there's a lot of special pleading there, because you couldn't say any of that against anyone else. But the liberal point of view says that history itself exists so that the U.S. and the U.K., run by Jews, can be revealed, and the Jews revealed as the mediators of the world. Now, of course, after the Russian collapse, there was no one who was claiming to be a liberal in Russia, but while entirely bankrupt at home, the Americans artificially promote liberal candidates, and when they're in public, they really rarely admit to that. The imposition of at least the partial imposition of a much more popular Eurasianist agenda was at least partly responsible for the massive recovery since 2001. The lesser people, then, are a small minority, but it does express expresses their ideology. It's an intellectual school financed by NGOs in the West in general, and of course is already taken for granted in the West. By proposing very simple answers to important questions concerning Russia, they can convert the weaker-minded. Now, of course, history isn't moved by theories or concepts, but ideas are important. History is moved by deeper and less rational experiences, or I should say less conscious experiences, connected with spiritual life and historical experience. And of course, the Jew today is that total negation. It's a design, to use Heidegger's term. You can't have a design without language. And of course, nothing has changed here in late 2024. And yes, the author here is talking about certain genetic traits that come from the landscape and in their historical experience. But if they're simply unconscious or subconscious, these character traits, these traditions, these feelings, aren't very effectual. They need to be institutionalized to, as he says, find an outlet in the arena of reason. they'll always be amorphous and ineffectual otherwise. In other words, they have to be given concrete expression and connected with real-life problems. And this is a very Hegelian position. But on the other hand, this schematic that I mentioned, because it's very simple and easy to grasp, and certainly in the context of 1990-1991, it can be accepted by otherwise intelligent people. Now, what Shafarovich says is that given the rapidity, and he was living in the midst of the Soviet collapse, which most people had taken for granted, except the CIA, this new agenda, which isn't that far from the earlier Soviet point of view. The Soviets said the exact same thing about Russian history, except with a more class basis. But if the mind, let's say, of the young person, the school, high school, college kid hasn't been prepared for this, because by the 1970s in the USSR, this was no longer the case. These agendas were coming from the U.S., not the Soviet Union. In fact, you had somewhat of a renaissance of the Orthodox Church in the 80s and 90s and Russian nationalist history. Now, he also predicts that these authors won't be known in 10 years, so by 2000. But he was also aware that regardless of whether people remember their names, it has a very powerful influence, and of course he was completely correct. It's extremely irritating about these now racially based, inbred traits inherent to Russianness, because you can't prove any of it. It's just, there's a lot of projection there. But Shafarovich says that, this alleged slavish submissiveness, and by the way, there's no connection between the word slave and Slav. That's ridiculous. Using our English translation of these words, that they're coincidentally connected doesn't mean anything. He brings out the old believer schism, which took at least half of the peasantry over 100 years. The majority of the peasantry rejected the alterations to the liturgy, and so people fled by the thousands in the forest, endured death, self-immolation. 300 years later, there's still no real solution to it. The old belief also led to these massive nationwide rebellions of Razin and Pugachev, among many others. And he brings up Henry VIII. Remember, they're looking to the U.S. and the U.K. as the source and the foundation of what they want Russia to be. He mentions Henry VIII creating this hybrid religion, little Catholic, little Protestant, and altering it throughout his lifetime. So towards the end, people really didn't know what their theology said. This was an era where either the crown or parliament was dictating doctrine, and the clergy were fairly submissive. The majority of the population accepted this reformed faith, completely concocted from political and personal considerations. And it's very difficult to avoid the fact that today the great majority of Americans accept the regime's accounting of events without question, no matter how absurd. And they have no idea where to go to get alternative information. Many of you remember, and I've quoted him before, Richard Pipes. He's your typical neocon in the sense that he was anti-Soviet. And I've used him many times for that. But it turns out that his anti-Soviet mentality was anti-Russian. And here's something that Pipes says about the religious issue. The secularization of church lands, which was probably the greatest cause of the European Reformation, took place in Russia as calmly as if nothing was involved but a simple bookkeeping operation. Now, we've talked about this at some length over the course of the 18th century. But as far as Protestants are concerned, what could be more submissive than the doctrine of he who holds the power determines the religion? The compromise idea from the religious world. The faith was entirely determined by their secular rulers. And in Russia, that would have been inconceivable. Now, some people say that the changes in the liturgy were fairly minor, but of course, it's more than just liturgy involved. So he's saying that in England, the king can invent religion, have parliament dictate doctrine, and with the exception of a handful of Catholics and Puritans, were generally well accepted. Trying to bring up the synodal system of Peter I, and I agree with him on that, it's pretty ridiculous since he copied it from European sources. Their view of the church is, you know, a lot of these people don't know much about Orthodoxy. So trying to claim to be a specialist in Russian history without knowing anything about Orthodoxy is kind of like being a specialist in the history of Tibet without knowing anything about Buddhism. But Shragin and other Jews say things like, the Russian psychological predisposition towards unanimous obedience was reflected most vividly and, so to speak, typically in the church's subordination to the state and the forms it took during the synodal period. As if to say that this didn't happen in Protestant country, where the church was completely politicized, at least for a time, and Peter copied them in building his synodal system. It's interesting to note, and he goes in some detail here, why until the middle or late 19th century, there were no utopian authors. Thomas More, you know, Campanella. Of course, there weren't any Medicis or Fuggers either. But the Protestant sectarianism, that was a breeding ground for socialist ideas, barely played a role in Russia. And, you know, there was no Reformation in Russia whatsoever. You can't find any parallels there. But things like the Munster Commune, their revolutionary doctrine of property being held in common, of course, a sexual revolution. The close you can get, and I did a lecture on Kitej and that conception of some kind of an Orthodox utopia. But even there, these folk utopias, you can't build anything. You can't build a socialist mind based on that. There's no, as Safarovitz would say, there's a lot of gentleness. There's no aggression. There's no violence. It's a condemnation of evil, and, opposing truth to falsehood, all the rest of it. But it has nothing to do with the violent and materialist doctrine that, and that's generally how he is referring to the word socialism. We're going to get that. You know, he wrote a book on the subject. We'll mention it here soon. But I think everyone knows that socialism and materialism were entirely imported into Russia from the West. It was always seen as something foreign. Dostoevsky actually referred to it as French socialism in his Diary of a Writer. And in Russia, you had two emigrants, Bakunin and Harrison, very different from one another, who started developing some variant of socialism only when they immigrated to the West. And Harrison recanted. So what's supposed to be archetypally Russian has no connection with Russia at all. It is altogether non-Russian in origin. And then he says something very striking. He says, this agenda, this schema that I recited to you a little while ago, that it completely and totally collapses in the face of any attempt to compare it to the facts. Because they're not making factual claims. They're making very vague psychological tendencies and traits, which, of course, don't take any kind of physical form. They vaguely, you know, make reference to genetics, but not explicitly. Another Jewish writer, Gregory Pomerantz, who was a dissident, but a very important opponent of Solzhenitsyn, and of course a Jew, is showing the total sloppiness of their reasoning. He writes that the tale of Dracula was found in Russia. Of course, it was elsewhere, but and that the Dracula proves that Russia was intoxicated by the cruelty of power. Of course, the point of this story, was concerned with the exposure of cruelty. Dracula and the devil are usually united in at least some of the early manuscripts of it. But Pomerantz kind of recanted later on, but he still makes the same Russians are inherently cruel kind of thing. And this is one of the first Jews to talk about Buddhism as an alternative to Christianity. And that became a trend, especially in the 90s and the early 2000s. And people like Pipes, who is not Jewish, but who certainly serves their interests, even makes the claim that there was no private property under Moscow. He says that there's an old Russian proverb that Safarovich cites, another person's tears are my water. That's kind of the origin of this drinking liberal tears kind of thing. And he claims that that's proof of the cruel cynicism of the Russian peasant. He doesn't understand, and again, this is very sloppy, that it's not, in his mind, not a condemnation of selfishness, but somehow a moral maxim. He then claims that there were no schools in medieval Russia, or pre-Petrine Russia, and it was an illiterate society. But back in 1892, Alexander Sobolevsky said that, we are accustomed to thinking that among Russians of that time, we're talking about the 15th to the 17th centuries, there were very few literate people. The clergy was relatively uneducated and part of it entirely illiterate. That in the higher social class, literacy was not very widespread, and that the lower class constituted an illiterate mass. Now, I've read him before, and he brings out, given indirect evidence, because there's no direct evidence, but the secular clergy was universally literate. Among the monastics, it's about 80%. Among the landowners, maybe half. And among the peasants, maybe between 15 and 20%. You had an entire network of schools going back long before Peter teaching basic reading and writing. So D.S. Likachev says that the level of literacy in the 17th century in Russia among all strata of the population was no lower than it was in the West. That has kind of, you know, this illiteracy argument has been blown away for a long time now. But so-called specialists in the field will continue to generate it, and it's part of the Jewish conception of the evil Russian and that that paradigm. So the regime, the liberal regime coming from the West, it's Jews and liberals in Russia proper, especially in the early 90s, essentially has two concepts. That Russian nationalism is one of the greatest dangers on the planet, number one. And number two, Russia has to follow the liberal democracies in building social life, especially when it comes to the Jews. That Russian national viewpoint is something that they don't even believe exists. There's a pseudonym named Gorsky, probably a Jewish Samizdat writer. He says, not a national revival, but a struggle for freedom and spiritual value should become the central creative idea of our future. And he says that the new national consciousness should not be built on subconscious patriotism. Safarovich says that, well, apparently, the 20 million who laid down their lives in the past war, meaning World War II, were motivated by class status. They'll go so far as to say that a destiny doesn't exist, a nation doesn't exist, except, of course, for their own. Even claiming that the destiny is intelligible is a huge temptation in their mind. The same Gorsky, and both by the pseudonym and kind of what he says, I'm certain he's Jewish, even starts off an article saying that the Russian person, even if he is capable of thinking independently, still agonizes over the question, what is Russia and what is the meaning of its existence. So clearly, Gorsky doesn't include himself and the Russian people. Talking about thinking independently, it's the last thing these guys do. They just recycle bad liberal arguments, almost word for word, and they did it then, and they're doing it now. Yanov, who I've mentioned already, one of the leaders of the Jewish liberal movement at the time, claims that the Russia's future and the future of the region, he was terrified by this renaissance of the Orthodox Church that was taking place at the time. So he was very concerned with trying to manipulate the church as a Jew, because Russia and the region, its future, would be dictated by the political orientation of the church, a church that he hated. So that's where the liberal ecumenical idea comes into play. At a minimum, that Christianity is neutered and it becomes non-national. The Jews were trying to yet again manipulate their main enemy, the church. In a preface of one of Jano's books, an author named Breslauer says that Yanov's sympathies are with the cosmopolitan stratum of Soviet society. But anything, according to Yanov himself, anything that suggests a Russian destiny or a Russian nation is, in his words, Tartar messianic and a threat to the world political process, something he claims to have access to. Of course, Jewish professors have been denying the existence of a nation, except the Jewish, for a long time now. But these Jews considered Russian nationalism, or really any nationalism other than their own, to be connected with anti-Jewish thinking. So getting back to the lesser people idea, Lenin used the term vanguard party, a very tiny minority, completely of one mind ideologically, leading a revolt, manipulating a revolt for the establishment of Marxism. It's the same concept. Now, the lesser people change. They take different forms depending on the circumstances. So he says concerning Western revolutions, Safarovich says this: one of the most interesting students of the French Revolution, in terms of both the freshness of his ideas and his remarkable erudition, Augustin Kutchin, paid special attention in his works to a certain social or spiritual stratum he called the lesser people. In his opinion, the decisive role in the French Revolution was played by a circle of people that had been established in the philosophical societies and academies, Masonic lodges, clubs, and societies. The specific features of that circle consisted in the fact that it lived its own intellectual and spiritual world, the lesser people among the greater. He could have said the anti-people, since the worldview of the former was based on the principle of the obverse of the latter's worldview. It was there that the type of person necessary for a revolution was developed, a person for whom everything that constituted the nation's roots, its spiritual backbone, the Catholic faith, the honor of the nobility, loyalty to the king, pride in one's own history, and attachment to the distinguishing features and privileges of one's native province, one's estate, or one's guild, was alien and disgusting. So the lesser people, the vanguard, create an artificial universe for themselves. And in fact, they live their entire lives in this bubble. Now, for normal people, in the ordinary world, everything is tested through historical experience. But among the lesser people, it's the general and prevailing opinion, not the factual nature of things. In other words, it's entirely intersubjective, not objective. And it's American academia in a nutshell. Same thing for journalism. What was real is what others believed, where the smart money was. What was true was what the leadership of this lesser people claimed. So the typical order of coming to know anything was completely reversed. And since they didn't hear much, and especially today where you have total censorship, they don't get challenged very often. Doctrine became the cause in their mind rather than the effect of living life. But these people had nothing in common with the countries within which they lived. So for all of these, it all comes down to some variant, this mechanical copying of either the UK or the American variant of liberal democracy. In order to do that, they have to sweep away, as the Soviets tried to do, the concept of old Russia, ignorant, warlike, totalitarian, things that are taken as for granted in the West. As I've already mentioned, once liberalism was adopted and Jews placed in the forefront of this reform starting in 1991, Russia completely collapsed into third world status. And of course, Russians forever rejected it. But the liberal opinion, the Jewish opinion, never changed. And that shows that the destruction of Russia was the point. They even try to claim that Russian communism is the same thing as their old Russian authoritarianism. Because they live an isolated existence, they don't realize that nothing is more totalitarian than liberal capitalism. The errors in these books that I've already cited, Tsarevich lays out, the errors are extraordinary. And it really, factual claims are not important. They already have a concept, and they go cherry-pick evidence to try to justify it. So you had stupid things, like there's no private property in old Russia. Yanov says that democracy is only 200 years old, that the Russian mind is entirely servile, claiming that, of all people, Vissarion Belinsky was a classic Slavophile, that Ivan IV Opichnina killed tens of thousands. As I mentioned, the story of Dracula somehow proves Russians love cruelty, and all these nonsensical claims. But that level of sloppiness, it causes Tsarevich to ask this question. Or I should say, to make the statement. The authors here examine Russian history exclusively on the plane of present-day consciousness, totally ignoring the requirement of historicism. And what he means there is proper historical method. Yet they're all people with an education in the social sciences, the humanities, and the facts that we've recalled should be perfectly well known to most of them. One must admit that we are dealing here not with sincere efforts to understand the meaning of Russian history, and not with historical philosophical reflections. What we are confronting is activity of a very different type. It is public affairs, journalism, and propaganda that strives to instill certain preconceived ideas and feelings in the reader. Also seems to be, according to him, configured to be aggressive, loud, and obnoxious. The lesser people's, their sense of self is meant to be a confrontation or the negation of the broader society, the nation within which it operates. And that nation, its interests, values, and traditions, the lesser people despise. Despite that fact, they do claim imperiously that they have the right to rearrange the society's affairs through revolution, treating it as just human resources, human fodder, for the achievement of their ideological aspirations. Now, Tsarevich tries to go back. This was a 40-page article. He can't do everything he wants to do here. But he traces the lesser people idea to Protestantism, specifically John Calvin. I want to quote him in this regard. This striking doctrine, which was really a new religion, created among the saved a sense of complete isolation from and opposition to the rest of humanity. Their central experience was a sense of their elect status, and even in their prayers they thanked God that they were not the same as the remaining mass. The idea of emigration played a colossal role in their worldview, partly because of the fact that the Puritan movement was originated by a group of Protestants who were fleeing persecution in the period of the Catholic reaction to Mary Tudor. In a state of complete isolation and disconnection from their homeland, they laid under the influence of Calvin's teaching the foundations of the theology and psychology of Puritanism. But it was also partly because even after they had returned to England, they remained immigrants, aliens, in terms of their views. A favorite image in their literature was the wanderer, the refugee, the pilgrim. The narrow communities of the saved were continually subject to purges and excommunications, which at times encompassed the majority of the communities. Now, we know the role of the Puritans in America's early founding. But the damned, since they're saved, those who are saved and those who are damned, within the church itself, we don't know for absolute certain, but there's some indications who belongs to what. They're still subject to the discipline of the church, and compulsion was to be found everywhere. the holy and the doomed, this gap, there was no room for mercy. Peasants who had lost their land had been sent by the throng to the cities in search of work, turning into vagrants. These were a particular object of denunciation and hatred in the Puritan mind. It was the Puritans who demanded very strict laws, extolling the whipping and branding of the poor, and demanded that the righteous be protected from contact with these vagrants. This is the mentality of Puritanism, what they took from Calvin. It had a lot to do with the Irish potato famine. It had to do with the English Revolution, which was extremely bloody. If you remember my talk on the potato famine, as well as E. Michael Jones' articles on the topic, it was this sense of saved and damned that helped permit the Puritans to reject any kind of mercy or virtue. The important and significant part of this is that their literature was to separate the saved from any historic tradition. They call it the tradition of the people of the world. And for the saved, all established customs, any kind of law, any kind of linguistic, dynastic, any tradition and attachment had zero force. Other than their conception of the Bible, it was pure nihilism. But the saved had the right to completely remake the world and all existing laws, customs, statuses, ordinances, and constitutions would be remade according to a plan known to them in advance. What's the image that they used? Building of the temple. The restoration of the temple of Jerusalem after the Jews returned from captivity. The English Revolution, which was largely a Puritan one, speaking very broadly, was heavily Judaic. So unfortunately, Calvin, even in this extreme interpretation, became dominant amongst Protestants in the U.S. And I mentioned before that there are some marks that may separate the saved from the damned. And I've already hinted at one, economic life. Why were the Puritans so obsessed with being separate from vagrants, poor people, and certainly the Irish? And it was because one of the marks of the saved was wealth. Using the Old Testament, specifically Abraham, as an example. The English Revolution really consisted in that by relying on the Puritans and even more extreme groups, this new stratum of the wealthy succeeded in overthrowing the traditional monarchy, the popular monarchy. It justified the great wealth of this elite, as Darwin would do a few centuries later. Back to socialism here. Of course, these are all tightly connected phenomena. Safarovich wrote a book which came out in English in 1980 called The Socialist Phenomenon. And he's very concerned with tracing the development of religious and non-religious variations of utopian socialism all the way up to his own age. And going through all of them, from the ancient world to now, the argument is that the basic principle of every single one of these is a drive to suppress not so much the individual, but the persona, the free agent that the community helps forge. And he breaks his argument down really into three parts. The first is the Chiliastic version. And he goes into some detail about, you know, the Platonic utopia, the Cathars, the Taborites, the Anabaptists, the English Civil War, bringing up people like Thomas More, Tommaso Campanella, as I already mentioned, the utopian socialist movement. The difference between utopia and a political theory is that utopia usually uses tremendous detail. You know, what time you get up in the morning, this kind of thing. But there's also non-religious, namely the state version, only in the most well-developed parts of the world. And he talks about the Incas, the Egyptians, places that already had relatively well-developed states, although not modern states, but had a functional bureaucracy. And he concludes all of this. You know, the point of him cataloging all this is to find out what they all had in common, even though they're extremely different from each other. And there are three persistent things based around the word abolition that they all have in common. Number one, the abolition of all private property. That is to say, property is shifted from the hands of private owners to themselves. Number two, the abolition of the family, which is just another way of talking about the sexual revolution, the so-called community of wives. And finally, the abolition of religion and the spirit. Of course, mainly Christianity, but not exclusively so. Now, different forms of ancient socialism, in his mind, were not necessarily ideological. But he goes so far as to say that a book like Utopia or City of the Sun reminds him of the Incan version of socialism in Central America. Socialism, ultimately, no matter what's behind it, is nihilistic. Not in the same sense that the Puritans were nihilistic, because we're talking about collectives here. Of course, the Puritans were too, at least if they knew who the saved were and who the damned were. But he goes so far as to say that it's the Freudian death drive that's behind all of these. Socialism is not about equality or free labor, but especially in the Soviet era, the alteration and replacement of nature, the transformation of all matter into a machine to mechanize the entire planet. It reduces everything to a machine without any kind of free will, overseen by a vanguard party claiming to bring the inevitable future world to man. And in that sense, the Puritan idea continues to be relevant to that. Talk about things like color revolutions and this whole lesser people ideal. You have the identical phenomena. How many times have I spoken of the fact that the leaders of these color revolutions have very little in common with anyone else in their target country? They speak English. They're educated in either England or America or both. Many of them speak their own language with an accent. So Safarovich says the following. The operatives of the vanguard have a belief in the people's future like a mechanism can be freely designed and restructured. And this connection, the contemptuous attitude towards the history of the greater people, up to and including the assertion that it has not existed at all, the demand that the basic forms of life be borrowed in the future from outside, and that we must break with our own historical tradition, the division of the people into an elite on the one hand and an inert mass on the other, and a firm belief in the right to use the latter as material for historical creativity. And finally, outright revulsion towards representatives of the greater people, that is to say, the nation, and their psychological makeup. That this phenomenon of the elect, doesn't matter whether it's the Puritan version or anything else, it's this cult of the saved in a state of hostile alienation from the spiritual foundations of the surrounding world. Again, the lesser people have no real connection with the country in which they live. And we talked about how, you know, the Soviets prepared the mind for this. But the concepts of the Leninist revolution were just platitudes by the 1970s and 80s. Safarovich says this, in the face of this refined technique of brainwashing that has been tested and practiced and improved through long experience, confused young people find themselves absolutely defenseless. For after all, no one who might be an authority for them will warn them that what they're dealing with is simply a new version of propaganda, a very toxic one, that is based on extremely fragile factual bases. Thus, even logic and facts and ideas by themselves are powerless in such a situation. And I dare say that everyone listening here knows exactly what I'm talking about. Because the chosen few, the lesser people, the vanguard, doesn't have any contact with their opposition. They only really know it through caricature. this is the case in academia. They don't even have access to our stuff. It's censored on every university's web connection. Of course, the censorship and money flowing to liberal NGOs in the East, that's sufficient to sway people, especially the intellectuals. But intellectuals, it's very hard to convince them that they've been fooled. And what Americanism has come down to now is because they don't have any association with the common people that they despise, or any intellectual who refuses to accept their point of view, they're at a stage where facts aren't really important anymore. And they're not important because everyone agrees. And there's no prestigious body to fight them. The concept of prestige, or really comes down to who has the most money, is considered to be the source of truth. When someone says that, oh, mainstream historians don't say that, mainstream psychologists don't say that, who are they talking about? They're talking about academics in the big universities, the big think tanks, tons of NGO money, the very money that allows them to be called the mainstream, allows them to promote themselves as the purveyors of truth. Most people, and they would never admit this, but especially in America, most people associate money and power with being respectable, and hence correct. It's almost a form of hypnosis. The mainstream of any field is usually the wealthiest, the biggest universities, the biggest grants. You hear it all the time. You say something and, oh, well, mainstream doesn't accept that. And, of course, they probably have never heard about what you're talking about, or they have a caricaturish version of it. But where the money is where the truth is. Now, by now, I think you've put it together that he's, to a great extent, at least in Russia, talking about the Jews. That's not always the case. And the fact that this was a mass circulation article here in its original form that's included in this collection from the Department of Commerce in the U.S. in 1990 is remarkable. I want to quote from Safarovich again. The fact that the authors we're examining here are often under the influence of strong Jewish national feelings is confirmed by many features of this literature. For example, by the place that is occupied in it by questions that concern only the Jewish national movement, the problems of emigration, and the fear of anti-Semitism, they surface in almost everything they do, every work. Another feature is even more universal and characteristic. The works under consideration might give the impression that the national aspect of life in general is alien to their authors, and that they even regard it with antipathy. But what is striking is, although the authors are for the most part Jews, they never try to apply to their own people and its state the criticisms that they level at Russians and Russia. For example, practically all the authors accuse Russians of nationalism, messianic tendencies, the arrogance of feeling themselves to be a chosen people. Now, of course, Russians don't claim that, but they think that the Third Rome, because they live in this make-believe world, they're not even aware of this blatantly, almost cartoonish projection. They don't hear their opposition enough. They only know it through, you know, third or fourth parties. Well, unsurprisingly, our author here was thrown out of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. Now, the NAS couldn't throw someone out. It's almost like a version of tenure. Of course, they never said what he said about Jews. But the very fact that he, but by the way, he never joined the American Academy of Sciences. They kind of put him there as a dissident, because all of a sudden that became fashionable. But of course, this very action of stripping him of things, he wasn't teaching anymore after this. And all that does is prove that his arguments on the Jews were correct. The concept of Messiah, that's not a Russian word. It's spelled pretty much the same, Messiah. That Berdiaev, for example, says that any messianic tendency is an imitation of the Jewish version. It is precisely among the Jews the notion of themselves as a chosen people and the anticipation of the Messiah. That's their foundation. And that, you know, the basis of the state of Israel. All claims the same thing that they're saying is terrible when it's done in Russia is perfectly okay when it's done by the Jews. Another thing that he's mentioning here is that I'm trying to figure out, some of these only have pseudonyms. If they refer to Russians or whatever their home country is in the third person, they're already saying that they're not a member. Now, Yanov, I mentioned Alexander Yanov, who was fairly famous at the time. He's not anymore. It says one thing we know he is, it's a Jew. But anything that's done in a national sense, Yanov and many others, that no matter what the agenda is of the national movement, it is the path that will inevitably lead to despotism. I mean, talking about spiritual rebirth, using the term Great Russia, a special role for Orthodoxy, even making truth claims at all. But who does this more than the Israelis and the Jews? But of course, he doesn't believe that this will inevitably lead to despotism. In fact, despotism is exactly what they created in Russia. The Jews were a heavy mixed in with the Bolshevik revolution and their capitalist revolution in 1990. In both cases, the total dispossession of the Russian worker, the Russian peasant, was done by a handful of Jews claiming to speak for the nation, this lesser people concept. And for all these people, the concept of anti-Semitism plays a very large role, which also is a giveaway as to their identity. Again, these people are soft because they don't hear anything else. They don't debate people like us. Michael Hoffman's not on CNN talking about these things. It's taken for granted. Again, facts don't matter if everyone agrees. Yanov goes so far as to say it's evil to bring morality into political science. Well, I don't know how he can possibly say that, since the entire liberal democratic idea is based on pseudo-virtues. But from the Jewish point of view, this phenomenon, this revolutionary vanguard, it becomes understandable. The concept is that if the Russian national movement wins, it will lead to results that are harmful to us. That's what happened already, and it's how things will always be. And quite often, the lesser people, and there are many, many journals and departments of history and anthropology, they'll come out and say that the Jewish nucleus plays a huge role in all of this. Boris Kazanov, again, that's a pseudonym. He's clearly Jewish, he says so. And let me quote him here in one of the Samizdat anthologies. Such is the situation of Russian Jewry, as it seems to me. I see no contradiction between my Jewish blood and the fact that I speak Russian, between the fact that I am a Jew and the fact that I'm a member of the Russian intelligentsia. To the contrary, I find that combination natural. I am convinced that to be a member of the Russian intelligentsia at the present time inevitably means being a Jew. Shragin, we've already cited, another one of these late 80s Samizdat writers, and a Jew, of course, talking about the intelligentsia, or this iteration of the lesser people. He comes out and says, the national makeup of the member of this Russian intelligentsia has little in common with the national makeup of the peasant, worker, or bureaucrat. And then he comes right out saying that, well, because they're Jewish. Yanov talks about the spiritual occupation, the transformation of Russia under what he calls the Western intellectual community. Yanov says that a new Baruch or Marshal will be needed to carry out this plan. But like it or not, this lesser people, this intelligentsia, is to a great extent responsible for the massive collapse of Russia in the 1990s. But these people claim, in whatever form this intelligentsia or the lesser people take, that they have the right, in fact, the obligation to lead and revolutionize and even destroy the society that surrounds them. The concept of the lesser people fits the Jewish mind perfectly. They have no desire to interact with the general population. They don't want to be seen as unclean. Sometimes they have to, of course. They can't be entirely separated. But that's something that's very important to them. You know, the Talmud has a lot to do with the fact that Jews are living in Gentile society. Therefore, they have to make certain concessions. But everything that I've said so far leads to the conclusion that this lesser people, this essentially a literary school, the manifestation of the ideology of the lesser people, is a reflection of their declaration of war on the nation. That explains everything. The antipathy for the Russian nation, Russian history, their annoyance at any attempt to look at life from a Russian national viewpoint, and their constant demand to break with the Russian past ideologically and design a future without reference to the Russian nation in Russia. Of course, today in academia, the nation itself, except for the Jewish one, is said to be non-existent. This is a world of war. And whatever iteration of the lesser people, wherever it comes from, has the exact same structure. 2,000 years, though, of Jewish isolation and their emancipation from the medieval strictures show them as revolutionaries. They have to reorient their mentality when the Kahal gave way in the late 19th century. So, as far as young people are concerned in this, you're talking about young Russians in 1990, they can't find points of view that would help them sort out their problems. They want to find fresh ideas in this fashionable world, especially foreign radio at the time. They go to the fashionable theater, read the trendy books with all the big names and all the big publishing companies, and slowly the young person is essentially brainwashed into calling Russia the land of fools. This is something that's taken a long time to perfect. But given the realities of the Soviet Union, young people in 1990 were totally defenseless against these people. It's very bizarre how, you know, his description of the Puritans, the lesser people in general, various revolutionaries, that their agenda is the same, whether it be 1918 or 1990. And when the young mind is not prepared to defend itself against this group of people, they believe that it's completely taken for granted that what they say is true. Russians are animals because all the prestigious and wealthy institutions say so. Maybe the Jews are the mediators of the world. But regardless of where this lesser people, this vanguard is to be found, the war that they wage against everyone around them is meant to destroy their religious and national foundations. Everyone that's been quoted so far, you know, Amalric, Yano, etc., they claim the right to despise and hate Russia, but beyond that, they still wanted to determine its destiny, drawing up plans for it. I don't think there was anything accidental about the economic collapse starting in 1992. They have this perpetual isolation from the psychology of the greater people and the total inability to understand its historical experience, again, except in caricature form. Of all the historical variants of this lesser people, their agenda is shockingly the same. They want to direct public opinion. Short-term concentration, public attention in their media to certain events or people, and usually on the denunciation of certain aspects of the surrounding life. Stuff like the Dreyfus case or the Belis case in Kiev. They include fabrications, support of authorities who are based exclusively on their power, which is hypnotic. With this kind of mentality, logic and facts are powerless. Our historical experience is really the only thing that can distinguish here the truth from the falsehood. But when all the mainstream writers are saying the same thing about how awful monarchy is and nationalism is a disaster, and they have the solutions, given the nature of censorship, they have no access to anything. They certainly can't get it on campus. Well, it means it's up to people like us. What he says in terms of combating it is to become conscious of it. That's precisely the task of Russian thought in 1990, as he said. To never permit the nature of what it is to be Russian to be shoved aside for this bizarre racialist conception of what a Russian is. The character of a Russian or anyone else comes from this web of interrelated customs coming over many centuries, facing problems and old ones and new ones. The essayist that I've been talking about here, the Russian lesser people, or the Jewish lesser people, could say something like the strong state played a great role in Russian history. And I get, you know, they're certainly right there, which might explain the early libertarian ideas of some of these dissidents, that if the only thing that the state could do is just, you know, very, as a night watchman state, you know, regulating economic and political competition and enforcing contracts, and if that's the only purpose of the state, the result could only be rapid and complete collapse. In other words, he's predicted what's going to happen in a couple of years. Because they have rejected the strong state, which they claim is something important to Russia. And strong, by the way, is a pejorative. It's not a good thing. That if the state is artificially restructured to just enforce contracts, collapse is coming. And he was absolutely right. Anyway, I think I've made my point here. I have a lot more material, as always. But the concept of the lesser people is very important. The vanguard party, whatever you want to call it. It's tailor-made for the Jewish idea, but is not exclusively Jewish. There weren't a lot of Jews involved in the Jacobin clubs in the salons in Paris. You know, he goes on to talk about the Jewish conception of revolution in 1917. But of course, it was too early for him to see the second revolution in 1991, 1992. Both Jewish, both completely dispossessed Russia as a country and impoverished it. So it kind of makes sense that they're going to have to consider Russians subhuman to justify their own destruction. And to a great extent, that's what the Russian lesser people aim to do. I've gone over. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.